Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to take about 3.5 minutes to make our listening audience aware, in case any of you are not, of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in, and tell you how to access them. In my broadcast, some of you have noticed that you hear very little about financial support, and that's deliberate. We really trust God here on that score and firmly believe that God pays for what He orders. The same policy is true in my local church ministry. Other than the teaching we offer on these broadcasts, over the years I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. But on this program, I don't say a lot about those resources, much as I don't say a lot about finances, and I guess that omission in terms of resources kind of defeats the purpose. So grab a pen and paper and get prepared to write down a website. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the 5 books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. In fact, that book, The Finality of Jesus Christ, is not a long book, but it's a very important book. And if anybody will let the Scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage, Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. Another book, A Life Worth Dying For, The Radical Meaning of Christian Excellence. Personally, I love that book. It's my heartbeat. And finally, one about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, the most recent article is my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study. We continue our exposition of the small epistle to Titus. The Apostle Paul wrote this close associate Gentile protege whom he had left in Crete to urge him to finish up the work that was left unfinished and to appoint elders in the churches there, because things were disarrayed. There was the encroachment of false teachers. There was a serious problem with Cretan character in general, and it was important to have church order and discipline. And for that, every church needed somebody on the point. So Titus was delegated the responsibility of bringing order and appointing elders for the churches in the various towns where communities of believers existed. As we look at this list, it is similar to the one that we have in 1 Timothy, where Timothy is instructed about appointing elders. Now, the major thing here, the big picture, is that elders must be people who are without reproach, who are blameless. That doesn't mean perfect. We've already explained that. But people of integrity, people who have credibility, people who show themselves trustworthy to those within and without the church. People who have the kind of Christian testimony that's not going to come back and bite the church and embarrass it. That's what Paul has in mind, and the details are just designed as, for instance, kinds of things. These are the kinds of things that will lend credibility or that will cost a leader credibility. So he said that an elder must be blameless. For example, there must be marital integrity. We've explained that. Whose children believe and are not open to the charge of being wild and disobedient. That is something that has to be nuanced, but obviously a man who cannot control his own children, a man who has little influence with his own children, may not be a hypocrite, but he's obviously not a leader. He's a man who needs to be led rather than to be a leader, because if he's not effective in the small situation, the home, who can expect him to be a good manager of the large situation, the church? That's the logic. Since an overseer manages God's household, he must be blameless and, among other things, on the negative side, he must not be overbearing. He must not be quick-tempered, in other words, a hothead. He must not be given to drunkenness. It's a common problem in our society today, but especially so in a society like that, where people did not drink water like we do. Water systems were not even safe like ours are safe, but they drank wine with all their meals, and just as people do with food, a lot got into alcoholic drinks with excess. Christian leaders must not be of that species, not given to drunkenness. I pointed out that what the scriptures condemn in food and drink is excess, and drunkenness is one major sign of immoderation. Here again, in the big picture, is lack of self-control. A person who cannot tame his taste for alcoholic drink, who can't discipline himself to avoid the sins and the destructiveness associated with excessive alcoholic consumption, such a person is not a fit and trustworthy steward of God's property. Such a person will inevitably bring reproach upon his Christian testimony. He will inevitably embarrass the church at some point and bring it into reproach. So whatever virtues such a person may have, one who has that vice is to be ruled out from leading a church. Moreover, Paul says, a church elder, pastor, overseer, shepherd, use any of the names you like. They all apply to the same person. Must not be violent. They won't have any credibility if they are. Word could be translated a brawler. Some men, often those who are very emotional and or insecure, and who also aren't skillful in verbal jousting, often compensate by the threat of physical violence to make their point. I grew up in a working class family, and I married a wife from a working class family. And I know working class people. And oftentimes they're better with their hands than they are with their tongues. And oftentimes they have low frustration points when they run into others who are more verbally agile than they are. So sometimes they want to settle matters not with logic, but with their fists. Not good. Again, that's the polar opposite of the Spirit of Christ, who taught us to turn the other cheek. This is another self-control issue here, so big in this epistle. You see, out-of-control people cannot be trusted to be good stewards of what belongs to God. The church belongs to Him. Doesn't belong to you. Doesn't belong to the pastor. It belongs to God. We're just stewards. This vice, being a brawler, is one of the surest ways to make a laughingstock of our Christian witness. Another thing that is a no-no in a church leader is pursuing dishonest gain. literally being greedy of base game. People who are always looking out for a way to make a fast buck or take advantage of others are among those most despised by the world, even though the world does these things. They hate those who are like themselves, but they most hate them when they pretend to be otherwise, and they're hypocrites. Having such a person as a church leader will always lead to scandal sooner or later, and contempt for Christ and His church. One of my younger brothers, who in the secular world was a major CEO at one time, not a believer, told me that in picking people, there were certain things he looked for. One of the things that he looked for was somebody who was very competitive. But another thing that he looked for, and Bernard grew up in a Christian home, he looked for people. This is a secularist speaking. He looked for people who were honest, because he said the other kind sooner or later will get you in trouble. And they certainly will in the church. If you have somebody who's got a hint of this vice, pursuing dishonest gain, you not only don't want them in the church if you can help it, but you definitely don't want them in Christian leadership. Don't touch a person like that with a 10-foot pole. Such folk are always cropping up in the ranks of the church. I've been here 4 years. Way back in the early days, we had a man who, by his own confession, he's now dead, went to prison for mail fraud and some other allied crimes. And he freely confessed that to me. And there were some other things he did that he should have gone to prison for, but I knew the law didn't. He still wanted to be a church elder. Can you believe that? Well, there was no way under heaven that was ever going to happen. But you have those kind, and they make their way into churches. And some of them are charismatic, and some of them are influential, and some of them have all these positive sides. And people say, what's wrong with Joe Doe? Well, there's plenty wrong if you know it, and if he's one who has this streak, keep far, far away. Rather, he must be hospitable. The Greek word means loving strangers, or as we might put it, user-friendly, to those who are in need or distress, whether they know them or not. It doesn't mean a social lion who opens his home and throws parties for his Christian friends. In context, in the ancient world, Christian travelers did not have a large choice of accommodations like we do today when they were on the road. You remember Abraham in the Old Testament was hospitable to strangers who came by his dwelling. Abraham did not know that he was entertaining angels. The same with Lot, who took two angels in his house for protection from hostile elements on the outside. He took them under his protective wing. Hebrews 13:1 reminds us, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some, like Abraham and Lot, have entertained angels without knowing it. The spirit of hospitality, however, does not mean opening your homes to every stray dog that comes along. That would be crazy and nonsensical. One has to have some common sense. Very often, these people roaming the streets that one might feel compassion for in one way and want to take in, many of them are very dangerous people, unstable as water. We have families, and we have to be cautious and sensible. Almost every week, if not every day, in some newspaper or other, you find situations just like that, where people out of compassion took in others kind of off the streets, so to speak, and were robbed and murdered. Those Paul primarily has in view here are strangers in the believing community who at any given time may need food and shelter. A pastor, an elder, an overseer, whichever term one uses, ought to be the kind of person of a disposition ready to provide those needs as possible and as practical. A person who's going to be a church leader ought to love what is good. That's a fairly general statement. But we're reminded in this world that not everybody is a champion of good. There are people out there who actually take pleasure in evil, and I'm sorry to say some of them show up in our churches. Over my long years, I've actually seen church people. You notice I didn't say Christian people. They're two distinct crowds, and both are in our churches. But I've actually seen church people who literally liked to stir things up, liked to watch a house burn, as I put it. And if a fire threatened to die down, they're the kind who would do what they could to stir up the embers just for the excitement of getting it going again. I've seen people in churches who literally take perverse delight in separating friends and dividing churches. because they're bored, because they hate themselves, because it just excites them. Such people are the devil's plants in our pews. Some people are just so full of self-contempt, just so bored with life, just so envious of the good relationships that others enjoy, that they secretly relish the opportunity to make others as miserable as they are. Obviously, no person of that character belongs anywhere near the leadership of the church. Sometimes they find their way in, though. Always look to those safe people who practice and promote what is good, not in the sight of the political correctness police, but in the sight of God. Don't ever assume that because somebody is in the church, that attribute, loving what is good, is a given. Let me tell you something. Religious people, again, I did not say Christian people, but religious people historically have been some of the cruelest persons imaginable. That statement may shock my listeners, but it is, I believe, true. I think, for example, if you would go back and read Josephus' Wars of the Jews, which was an on-the-scene account of the downfall of the Jewish nation in the years leading up to 70 A.D., when the Roman general Titus finished the job finally, you would see an appalling example of that, for the Jewish people were religious people. But oh my, how cruel and vicious they proved themselves to be in those days. Another example of the cruelty and the meanness of religious people would be the horrors of the Inquisition staged by the Roman Catholic Church in the wake of the Protestant Reformation and trying to root out heretics by every savage means possible. Churches, my friends, if you don't know this, are populated by religious people and Christian people, and the two are not necessarily the same. The former, religious people, can be as mean as water moccasins. In my 50 years of ministry, thus far I've seen both kinds in the pews and, I'm sorry to say, in church leadership. Again, don't take this qualification for granted, loving what is good, in assessing the fitness of a man for shepherding the flock of God. If you do, you may get a predator instead of a pastor. Well, here it comes again. Paul's going to ring this bell again and again in this epistle. An elder, a pastor, a shepherd, an overseer, must be one who is self-controlled. Sophron, the Greek word, means of sound mind, sane, sensible, and then it comes to mean self-controlled. Since self-control is a natural outgrowth of someone who is sane and sensible and sober-minded. There is much emphasis in this short epistle, as I've said, on this attribute, and most especially in view of the fact, as Paul will mention, that the Cretan character was notoriously short on this Christian virtue. It is not that Christian leaders are to be humorless, folks. They're not to be iron-faced Nazis who can never crack a smile or enjoy a little fun. The point is, a man of God should be a person who is basically serious. Not one who is frivolous, not a goof-off, but somebody who comes to the table of life with a sober sanity that causes him to put a bridle on his emotions, to put the brakes on his appetites, so that they do not run away with him, but rather he remains very much in control of them. He's sane enough, sober enough, sensible enough to know when enough is enough. In other words, he knows when to say no. He knows when to get serious and cut to the chase. An elder must be upright. The Greek word means one who is righteous or just in his dealings with others, as opposed to shady. He must be somebody who wouldn't show partiality to friends or family. That's often a problem in churches when things go wrong, when there are issues. People will side on a party basis rather than a principle basis. They are not righteous and just in dealing with that. Those people who will put at risk their familiar relationships in order to do the right thing. Those people are hard to find. I had a couple of guys in my church one time, whom to their everlasting credit and my everlasting respect, stood up and did just that. They had friends, they thought dear friends, but they were doing the wrong things. And they looked them right in the eye and told them, "This is not right. What is wrong with you?" And they lost those friends. Actually, they didn't really lose anything because those friends were just trying to use them. And they saw that. But before they saw that, they did what is right. That's the kind of man. That's the kind of pastor. That's the kind of overseer. That's the kind of elder you want. Somebody who's upright. He can be counted on to do right by others, even if he suffers in the process, even if he alienates family or friends or loses money. Those kind of people don't grow on trees. They're products of God's grace. It would also be a man who is holy. It's a peculiar word here for holy, hasios. It means religiously right. I think the idea is devout or scrupulous in practicing the faith. It means the kind of person who takes their religious duties seriously, and they try at all times to keep dutifully within God's lines. And here it is again. It's a different word than sophron, but meaning generally the same thing, self-controlled, temperate, a person not given to excesses and emotions or appetites. I can't believe how many times he hits this chord. The church, not only then, not only in Crete, but today. The church needs leaders who are in control of their habits, not ones whose habits are in control of them, because those whose habits are in control of them will invariably embarrass Christ. They will invariably scandalize the church and discredit themselves. It's just a matter of time. And church leaders should also be those who hold firmly to the trustworthy message as it has been taught. One who holds firmly to the apostolic faith that has been handed down to the church. The apostolic faith, I've explained, is the gold standard. Anything that deviates from that faith is headed off into heterodoxy or heresy, and perhaps even apostasy. Right here, on this business of holding firmly to the trustworthy message as it has been taught, right here, folks, is one place where, down through the centuries, local churches have most egregiously failed. It is a place where today our denominations have most obviously failed, and our seminaries and other religious institutions have so miserably failed. Time and time again, we have entrusted our churches and institutions to Christian leaders whose faith is squishy at best and non-existent at worst. I've mentioned being around pastors who, to my face, have told me they did not believe in the deity of Christ. They did not believe in the vicarious atonement of Jesus on the cross. They did not believe in the resurrection. They did not believe in the second coming. And they did not believe that the scriptures represented the word of God, among other things. They were apostates. They were unbelievers, but standing in the pulpits and pastoring Christian churches, and the people were generally none the wiser. I remember when I was a college kid working at the West Virginia Baptist camp, I think I've mentioned this to others, and I took it upon me, because nobody would believe me, to interview church leader after church leader who came to that camp. And it was shocking how many of them were in the vein that I just mentioned, some of them not quite that radical, but most not believing in the inspiration of Scripture and some of those other doctrines. They were certainly not paragons of apostolic orthodoxy. We have failed, and we continue to fail, in picking church leaders and vetting church leaders to make sure that they hold firmly to the trustworthy message as has been taught, the faith once for all delivered to the saints. It does no good to have religious authority ruling our churches if, in fact, those religious authorities are morally corrupt and theologically out to lunch. By that I mean not in line with apostolic orthodoxy. All I can say is let us be glad that God is sovereign, that he knows and keeps those that are his. For otherwise, Christian churches would go straight to hell in a handbasket, folks, given our poor stewardship of it down through the centuries. The remarkable thing is that it has survived, and it is as strong as it is, despite, on the human side, our catastrophic mismanagement of this stewardship. We have to leave it right there. God bless you, dear friends, and tune in again next time.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com, and our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.